Hello, everyone. We're continuing on with Thomas Manton, an exposition with notes upon the Epistle of Jude. We're still in verse 2. Mercy unto you and peace and love be multiplied. And we're currently going through love still. And we finished up last time arguments to press you to love, that God has commanded it, firstly. Secondly, and God has deserved love. And that's where we left off last time. And Lord willing, we're going to continue on with the third one. Thirdly, we'll go ahead now. The third and next argument is God has desired it. What does the Lord see in our hearts that he should desire them? If a prince should not only make love to a vile and abject creature, I believe make love back then meant like just, romance someone. A vile and abject creature, but seek all means to gain her affection, you would count her very froward and unthankful to give him the denial. Christ does not only oblige us, but woo us. If man were such as he should be, he would not need enforcements because of the multitude of his obligations. And if the Lord did deal with us as we deserve, he would slight us and scorn us rather than woo us. He does not want lovers or lack them. There are angels enough in heaven whose wills and affections cleave to him perfectly. Yea, God does not need the love of any creature. He doesn't need it. All this wooing is for our sakes. Wherein can frail man be beneficial to God? In what way? What increase of happiness has he if all men should love him? It is his happiness to love himself, and he would have us to share in this happiness. Therefore, he threatens and promises and beseeches. As one that would gladly open a door, try the key after key, till he has tried every key in the bunch, so does God try one method after another to work upon man's heart. Number one, he threatens eternal torments if we do not love him. 1 Corinthians 16:22. If any man love not the Lord Jesus Christ, let him be anathema maranatha. The form of speech implies the most dreadful curse that may be. It is not arbitrary whether you will love him or no. You are either to love him or to perish eternally. Among men, if love does not come kindly, we neglect it. That which is forced is nothing worth. Yet the Lord is so earnest after the love of the creature that he would have it by any means. Number two, he promises, we have not only mercies in hand, but mercies in hope, not only obligations, but promises. It is our duty to love God. If there were no heaven, our obligations might suffice. Yet what great things hath God provided for them that love him? 1 Corinthians 2, verse 9. If a man should sell his love, he cannot have a better chapman than God, who is most rich and most liberal. If an earthly potentate should promise to them that love him half the kingdom, he would find lovers enough. God has promised glory, the kingdom of heaven, and shall we not take him at his word? The Lord will give a gift for a gift because he has given us to love him. Therefore, he will give us heaven as the reward of love. Who ever heard that a hungry man was hired to eat and rewarded for tasting dainty food? Or a thirsty man for drinking. The love of God is so excellent a privilege that we should endure all torments to obtain it. And yet God has promised a reward. Yea, he is pleased to bargain with us as if he were our equal and we were altogether free before the contract. Number three, again, he beseeches. We are cold and backward, therefore he uses entreaty upon entreaty as if he were impatient of a denial. Out of what rock was man hewn? God himself comes a-wooing, and we have the face to give him a repulse. And what does he woo for but our hearts, which are his already, by every kind of right and title? Proverbs 23, verse 26, my son, give me thy heart. God is pleased to call that a gift, which is indeed a debt. Though the heart be due, it's due him, yet God will put this honor upon the creatures to receive it from them in the way of a gift. It is but equity to give to God the things that are God's. Look upon the heart, see if any could make it but God himself, whose image and superscription doth it bear. Will you refuse to surrender up to God his right? God has made it, bought it, and yet he begs it. When you have been as earnest with God and asked anything regularly of him, did he deny you? It is no benefit to him. He desires the heart of the creature, not that he may be happy, but that he may be liberal. He would have your heart that he may make it better. How easily do we give up our affections to anything but God, who has the best title to them? If the world or Satan knocks, we open presently. We are as wax to Satan and as stone to God, exorable and easy to be entreated by any carnal motion. As some hard stones cannot be wrought upon but by their own dust, so men are facile only to their own corruptions, or easy toward them, to their own lusts, which are corrupt desires of the hearts, and not just a sexual thing. So to their own lusts, not to the motions of God's Spirit. All right, and that was the end of thirdly. And fourthly, the nature of love shows that it is fit for nothing but God. He has given us this faculty and disposition that we may close with himself. He that looks upon an axe will say it was made to cut, and he that looks on love will say it was made for God. What is the genius and disposition of love? Love is nothing but an earnest, bent, and strong motion of the soul to what is good for us. Every man has an inclination in his nature to what he conceives to be good, Psalm 4, verse 6, and grace does only direct and set it right. All the difference between nature and grace is in fixing the chiefest good and the utmost end or purpose or aim. One great blessing of the covenant is a new heart, that is, a new and right placing of our affections. Well, then, God is the chiefest good. Even nature cannot be satisfied without him, but grace finds all contentment in him. If there be any good in the creatures, it is originally in him. He is the fountain of living waters, where comforts are sweetest and freest. The heart hunts after good among the creatures, which is but an image and ray of that perfection which is in God, and who would leave the substance to follow the shadow and prize the picture to the disdain of the person whom it represents. It were easy to prove that God is the only proper, eternal, all-sufficient good of the soul, and if the heart were not perverted and biased with carnal desires to other objects, it would directly move to God as all things do to their center. I say, were it not for sin, we should no more need to be pressed to love God than to love ourselves. There need no great motives to press us to love ourselves. Nature is prone enough of this of its own accord. And if nature had remained in that purity wherein it was created, it would move to God of its own accord, as all things move to their center, and there they rest. Now God is the center of the soul. The soul's good is not honors, pleasures, or profits. The soul is a spirit and must have a spiritual good. It is immortal and it must have an eternal good. By experience, we find that our affections are never in their due posture, but are like members out of joint, whereas the arms, when they hang backward, when they are not fixed upon God. Therefore, there is a restlessness and dissatisfaction in the soul. We grope and feel about for happiness and cannot find it, Acts 17, 26 and 27. Like Noah's dove, we hover up and down and find no place whereon the sole of our foot should rest. Well then, if God be the only all-sufficient good of the soul, why do not we love him more? If he be the center of the soul, why do we not move directly thither? It is a shame that a stone should be carried with greater force to its center than we to God. By its natural course, it falls downward and breaks all things in the way, yea, though itself be broken in pieces. But alas, how little do we break through impediments, I'm sorry, but alas, how little do we break through impediments to go to God. It were a miracle to see a stone stopped in the air by a feather, but now every vain thing keeps us off and intercepts our affections. Sin has given us another center, and after grace received, we hang too much that way, even still. Again, as love is for good, so it is for one object. Like a pyramid, it ends in a point. Affection is weakened by dispersion, as a river by being turned into many channels. In conjugal love, where friendship is to the height, there is but one that can share in it. That is the law of nature, Malachi 2, verse 15. Did he not make one, yet he had the residue of spirit? The meaning is that God made but one man for one woman, though he had spirit enough to make more. It was not out of defect of power, but wise choice, that their affections to one another might be the stronger, which otherwise would be weakened, as they are in the brutes scattered promiscuously to several objects, like the beasts will mate with other mates. So the true object of love is one God. He is loved for himself and other things for his sake. Once more, the force and vehemency of love shows that it was made for God. Love is the vigorous bent of the soul and full of heights and excess, which, if diverted to other objects, would make us guilty of idolatry. We should place them in the room of God, if we do that. Still, we find that, and we do that, and when we divert our love to other things, especially above God. Still, we find that men are besotted with what they love, as Samson was led about like a child by Delilah. All conveniences of life, pleasures, profits are contemned for the enjoyment of the thing beloved. Now, these are heights proper to the divinity, to the infinite majesty of God. To whom else is this vehemency and this self-denial due? If we lavish it upon the creatures or anything created, we make gods of them, and therefore covetousness is called idolatry, Ephesians 5, verse 5, and the sensualist is said to make his belly his god, Philippians 3, 19, or those who live to please senses of any kind. There is such an excess, such a doting in love, that if we be not careful in fixing it, before we are aware, we run into practical idolatry and practical atheism. There is an atheism in the heart as well as in the judgment. Atheism in the judgment is when we are not convinced of the being of God, in the heart when our affections are not set on God. This is more incurable because the dogmatical atheist may be convinced by reason, but the practical atheist can only be reformed by grace. And thus the nature of love shows it. And that's the end of point four. All right. Fifthly, the nature of the saint shows it. The new nature has new affections. It bereaves itself by the new heart as well as by the renewed mind. Romans 12, verse 2. There are not only new thoughts, but new desires and new delights, desires after God and a delight in God as the fountain of holiness. When we come to God at first, we love him out of spiritual interest for ease and comfort and the benefit we gain by him. Christ allows it. Come to me and I will give you ease, Matthew 11, 28. When fire is first kindled, there is as much smoke as flame, but afterwards it burns brighter and brighter by degrees. A fountain, as soon as digged, runs muddy at first, but afterwards the stream grows more pure and clear. So does the love of the saints. At first it is but a love of interest, but by acquaintance we love him out of a principle of the new creature, for his holiness and excellency, because that which is in us in part is in God by way of eminency and perfection. Certainly likeness must needs beget love, and the saints, being conformed to God, delight in him, so that then their love flows not so much from profit and interest as grace, yea, at length out of a vehement complacency of the new creature. They love holiness above happiness or spiritual interest, and hell is not so bad as sin in their account. There cannot be a worse hell to them than unkindness to God or grieving his spirit. And heaven is amiable for God's sake because he is loved there and enjoyed there, much more than here, and in perfection there. There is none of God's enemies in heaven, and there they shall serve him and cleave to him without weariness and wandering. Well, then, there is such a disposition in the saints to love God, in Psalm 31:23, which arises not only from hope, because of the great benefit which we expect from him, nor only from gratitude, or the sense of his love already showed, although those do play a part, but from an inclination of the new creature, and that sympathy and likeness that is between us, because we hate what he hates and love what he loves, Proverbs 8:13 and Revelation 2 verse 6, and because God is the original fountain and sampler of holiness. Use. We get to use. Well then, saints, mind your work. Do you indeed love God? Christ puts Peter to the question thrice, John 21. A deceitful heart is apt to abuse you. Ask again and again, do I indeed love God? Evidences are these, the following. Number one, if you love God, he will be loved alone. Those that do not give all to God give nothing. He will have the whole, the entire heart. If there were another God, we might have some excuse for our reservations. But since there is but one God, he must have all, for he does not love inmates. When the harbingers take up a house for a prince, they turn out all, everyone. None must remain there, that there may be room for his greatness. So all must avoid that God may have the sole possession of our hearts. The devil, that has no right to anything, would have a part, for by that means he knows the whole will fall to him, or all of it. Conscience will not let him have all, and therefore he would have a part to keep possession. As Pharaoh stood hucking with Moses and Aaron, if not the Israelites, then their little ones, if not their little ones, then their herds, if not their herds, then their flocks. But Moses tells him there was not a hoof to be left. So Satan, if he cannot have the outward man, yet he would have the heart. If there be not room enough in the heart for every lust or corrupt desire, then he craves indulgence in some things that are less odious and distasteful. If conscience will not allow drunkenness, yet a little worldliness is pleaded for as no great matter. But the love of God cannot be in that heart where the world reigns. Dagon and the ark could not abide in the same temple, neither can the heart be divided between God and mammon. All men must have some religion to mask their pleasures and carnal practices, that they may be favorable to their lusts and interests with less remorse, and usually they order the matter so that Christ shall have their consciences and the world their hearts and affections. But alas, they do not consider that God is jealous of a rival, of any rival. When he comes into the heart, he will have the room empty of anything else. It is true, we may love other things in subordination to God, but not in competition with, that is, when we love God and other things for God's sake, in God and for God. When a commander has taken a strong castle and placed the garrison in it, he suffers none or doesn't allow any to enter but those on his own side, keeping the gate shut to his enemies. So we must open the heart to none but God and those that are of God's party and side, keeping the gate shut to others. We may love the creatures as they are of God's side, as they draw our hearts more to God, or engage us to be more cheerful in service, or give us greater advantages of doing good. Of what party are they? Bring nothing into your heart and allow nothing there that is contrary to God. When Sarah saw Ishmael scoffing at Isaac, she thrust him out of doors. So when riches and honor and the love of the world upbraid you with your love to God, as if you were a fool to stand so nicely upon terms of conscience, etc., when they encroach and allow Christ no room but in the conscience, It is time to thrust them out of doors that the Lord alone may have the preeminence of our souls. Number two, this love must be demonstrated by solid effects, such as are the following. Number one, a hatred of sin. Psalm 97, verse 10, ye that love the Lord, hate evil. With love to the chiefest good, there will be a hatred of the chiefest evil. Friends have common loves, as I said, and common aversations, or things they are against. Upon every carnal motion, does your heart recoil upon you and say, how can I do this wickedness and sin against God? Genesis 39, 9. Or else, is this thy kindness to thy friend? Or, after such a deliverance as this, etc. Ezra 9, verse 13. Love to God will be interposing and crossing every carnal motion. Number two, by a delight in obedience. 1 John 5, 3. This is love, that we keep his commandments, and his commandments are not grievous. Nothing is difficult and tedious to him that has any affection to his work. As the prophet cured the bitterness of the wild gourds by casting in meal, so mingle but a little love with your work, and the bitterness is gone. Shechem yielded to be circumcised for Dinah's sake because he loved her, and Jacob endured his 7 years' service for Rachel's sake. So will love make us obey God cheerfully in things contrary to our natural inclination. Love and labor are often coupled in Scripture, 1 Thessalonians 1, verse 3, Hebrews 6, verse 10, and those that left their first works had lost their first love, Revelation 2, 4, and 5. Another evidence, evidence 3, delight in God's presence and grief for his absence, or a holy sensibleness both of his accesses or excesses and recesses to and from the soul. Can a man love God and be content without him? If you lose but a ring which you affect or have affections for, how are you troubled till you till it be found again? Ye have taken away my gods, he says, and do you ask what aileth thee? Judges 18:24. So when God is withdrawn, all visits of love and influences of grace are suspended, and they have no communion with him in their duties. Should they not mourn? See Matthew 9, verse 15. Is spiritual love without all kind of passion? Or are they Christians that are stupid and insensate? Stupid usually meaning like in a stupor. So they're in a stupor or insensate, or they can't sense, and never take notice of God's coming and going? These are evidences. I shall only now suggest two helps to keep up and increase this love to God, and I have done with this argument. Number one, prize nothing that comes from God unless you can see his love in it. God gives many gifts to wicked men, but he does not give them his love. The possession of all things will do us no good unless we have God himself. Other mercies may be salted with a curse. God's children are not satisfied till they can see him and enjoy him in every comfort and mercy. Esau was reconciled to Jacob, and therefore Jacob says in Genesis 33:10, I have seen thy face as the face of God. It was a token and pledge of the gracious face of God smiling on him. Hezekiah was delivered out of a sickness, and then he does not say, you have delivered me from the grave, but Thou hast loved me from the grave. Isaiah 38, 17. And number two, prize nothing that you return to God unless there be love in it. We accept a small gift when the party loves, and otherwise the greatest is refused. If I give my body to be burned and have not love, etc. 1 Corinthians 13, 3. Love is an act of grace by itself. Other duties are not acts of grace unless they come from love, as alms, fasting, prayer, martyrdom, etc. They are all nothing, says the apostle, I am not only little, but nothing. On the other side, small things are made great by love, as a cup of cold water, a poor woman's mite. They are accepted as coming from love. All right, and that is the end of the larger section about the matter of the prayer, of the overall verse. And then, Lord willing, we will plan to go on. He talks about the manner or degree of enjoyment and that it be multiplied. And then he goes through his notes from there. But until then, go in an understanding and a growth in the knowledge and understanding of God and his love, and in a love to him. And Lord willing, we will talk to you again soon.